Arwa Damon, I want to ask you about the journalists killed. Estimates between 90 and 130, 140 journalists killed by Israel in Gaza alone. You are an award-winning journalist for CNN for 18 years, covered the U.S. attack on Iraq. I wish we saw your reporting more. You mainly did it for CNN International, which would show the picture of the statue of Saddam Hussein coming down in a split screen with the casualties of war, where CNN Domestic would just show the statue of Saddam Hussein coming down hundreds of times. But your reporting was extremely important. I want to talk about seeing the images of casualties on the ground in Gaza. Right now, Israel doesn't allow international journalists in, and domestic journalists in Gaza, so many of them have been killed. Can you talk about the significance of this? Because that leads to people around the world caring to put more pressure.
You know, this is the first time, I would argue, that Gazans have control over the way that their story is being told. And that has made, to a certain degree, the understanding that the Western world has about what's actually happening in Gaza and the toll of all of it shift slightly, because the Western media does not control Gaza's story anymore. Gazans do. I have to say, I mean, I have so much respect and admiration for all of Gaza's journalists, because, you know, when we go into a war zone, wherever it is, as journalists, there comes a point when we get to rotate out. Right? You can tap out, you can say, like, I need a break, you know, send in the next crew. They have not been able to tap out for 6 months. And they're not reporting on something that is happening, you know, to a different population. They're reporting on their own people, what's happening to their own families and to their own loved ones. This ongoing effort, however, it would most certainly seem, to try to silence Gaza's journalists is extraordinarily disturbing, but it is sadly part of this whole overarching desire to control the narrative. And right now, though, it's not working, because Gaza's journalists and Gazans, they're not going to stop. And they deserve to be commended for that and for the awareness that they're actually raising about what is happening to them. And it's very, very disturbing, but to a certain degree makes sense from a PR perspective, that Israel is not allowing Western journalists in. Because if the scenes that Gazans are witnessing every single day were part of, you know, the regular broadcasts that are happening, there would be a much bigger and stronger outcry than what anything that we're seeing right now. I mean, you know, I went into the European hospital, which is basically southern Gaza's currently largest and only really remaining, you know, significantly functioning hospital. You walk into, you know, the hospital courtyard, the outdoor pathways, and it's streams of tents, and there's sewage lines running next to the tents. And this is inside a hospital. And people have crammed themselves into the hospital corridors themselves. You have bed after bed of injured, and the injured children with amputations, with horrific burns. I walked into the ICU, and there was, you know, a 10-year-old boy, and the ICU nurse said he's a gunshot victim. He took a gunshot bullet straight to the head.
I want to ask you, we only have about a minute for this segment, but I wanted to ask you, we've mentioned that you were a CNN reporter for 18 years, covered many conflict zones. How do you look at the coverage of CNN since October 7th and the degree to which not only CNN, but most Western media outlets are always deferring to Israel to make sure that Israel gets a chance to comment on every single story that they write or that they produce?
You know, October 7th happened and then the coverage began, and I immediately was catapulted back to the post 9/11 era. And I was in New York when 9/11 happened. And my hair stood on end, because it was the same level of, you know, dehumanization that we saw back then. It was the same sort of, you know, panicked kind of one-sided to a certain degree reporting that we saw back then. And it was extremely upsetting because one would hope that, you know, we, the journalism world, the Western journalism space, would have learned the lessons of post 9/11 and that we wouldn't sort of default into this whole dehumanization of the other. And I think it's really important that all journalists are cognizant and should know, you know, we go all over the world. You know, there's a basic fact that we should all know. And that is that, you know, people, we're the same. We love the same. We laugh the same. We live the same. We feel pain in the same way. And yet there was this default back into this dehumanizing rhetoric, this sort of us against them issue. And it was absolutely devastating and gutting and heartbreaking to witness and see that, you know, we defaulted back into sort of that same rhetoric and that same, you know, dehumanization of a population that perhaps, you know, for very superficial reasons, we don't perceive as being like us. And this desire to sort of inflict collective punishment on an entire people.
Arwa Damon, I want to thank you for being with us. Just returned from a humanitarian trip to Gaza, award-winning journalist with CNN, but now founder of Inara, a nonprofit currently providing medical and mental health care to children. Also non-resident senior fellow at Atlantic Council. Spent 18 years at CNN as a senior international correspondent. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue on Gaza, lawyers representing Germany at the International Court of Justice delivered their concluding remarks at The Hague today in a case brought by Nicaragua, which has accused Germany of facilitating the commission of genocide in Gaza by providing military and financial aid to Israel. Nicaragua has asked the UN's top court for emergency measures, ordering the German government to halt its support to Israel. Germany is Israel's second largest arms supplier after the U.S. In 2023, Germany approved arms exports to Israel valued at over $353 million, roughly 10 times the sum approved the previous year. For more, we're joined by Kenneth Roth, visiting professor at the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs, served for nearly 30 years as the executive director of Human Rights Watch. He's joining us now in New York. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Ken. It's great to have you with us. Can you explain why Nicaragua is simply taking on Germany and the significance of this case, another case being brought to the UN's top court?
Obviously, the United States would have been the ideal target. The U.S. is the principal armor of the Israeli military. But the U.S. Has a much more limited acceptance of the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice. It basically has to consent to every suit, and it was not going to consent to this suit. Germany is a much more open-ended acceptance of the jurisdiction. So Germany being the second largest armor of the Israeli military, it was the target. Now, in terms of the significance, the court has already found that this is a plausible case of genocide. And Nicaragua is saying, Germany, you are arming potential genocide. They also have added that Germany is arming actual war crimes, violations of international humanitarian law, which it clearly is. Now, there is a precedent for this. If you remember back to Charles Taylor, the former president of Liberia, he was convicted of aiding and abetting war crimes in neighboring Sierra Leone and is actually currently serving a 50-year prison term in Britain for that crime. So the International Court of Justice is a civil court. It's not a criminal court. But Nicaragua is basically pursuing the same theory, saying, you know, this is at least war crimes. It's plausible genocide. You're arming it. That's aiding and abetting. You should stop. That's the essence of the case.
I wanted to ask you, Kenneth, there were 40 Democratic members of Congress, including former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who have written to President Biden urging him to halt new arms transfers to Israel in the wake of the killing of the World Central Kitchen aid workers. What's your sense of the prospects for possibly halting or at least significantly reducing U.S. arms shipments to Israel?
Well, you know, one, that has been the line that Joe Biden has been unwilling to cross. He has spoken at this point quite eloquently, pushing Israel to stop bombing civilians, to allow more food and humanitarian aid into Gaza. But these, from Netanyahu's perspective, are just empty words because Joe Biden never backs them up with consequences. And the obvious consequence, the obvious huge leverage that the U.S. government has, is the $3.8 billion in annual military aid it gives Israel and the regular shipment of arms, you know, almost every week in the course of this conflict. And Biden has not been willing to explicitly condition those that aid, those arms sales, on ending the bombing and starving of Palestinian civilians. Now, we heard last week that in the private phone call with Netanyahu, Biden suggested that at some point in the future, this might be conditioned, you know, that U.S. relations will depend on how Israel responds. But it was all very vague. And of course, Netanyahu responded with equal vagueness. He says, okay, at some point, I'll open up the new crossing into northern Gaza to allow more food aid in. But that'll take a few weeks, and I'm not saying anything about whether I'll impose the same kind of obstructions in the north as I've imposed in the south. And I won't say anything about, you know, Israel's shooting at Palestinian police officers so that there's chaos when you try to distribute the food. You know, none of that is on the table. So in essence, Biden is not using this huge leverage, despite the pleas of an increasing number of lawmakers in Washington, you know, despite rapidly changing U.S. opinion polls saying Americans are tired of the U.S. actively supporting these war crimes, this plausible genocide in Gaza.
Why is he doing this? I mean, it is amazing to see the split in the Democratic establishment. I'm not just talking about the protesters on the streets who definitely are driving this split. But, you know, you have now Senator Warren of Massachusetts saying she believes Israel's assault on Gaza meets the legal definition of genocide. You have Christopher Coons, who I consider a Biden whisperer, who is now talking about halting weapons sales to Israel. But you have Biden resisting, though he has talked about a ceasefire. Why is this so difficult for him? What do you think it would take, especially now that you have Netanyahu saying that he set the date certain for invasion of Rafah?
He just won't tell us what that date is. Yes. Amy, that's the big psychoanalytic question, and we just don't know. I mean, part of it, I think, is that Joe Biden, you know, who is an older man, as we know, you know, thinks of Israel back in 1967. When it was the Davids surrounded by the Goliath of all the Arab states attacking Israel. He doesn't think of Israel today, the regional superpower, a nuclear-armed state, a state that has been occupying Palestinian territory for decades and is imposing apartheid. You know, that's just not in his mind. More to the point, he seems to be making a political calculation, and he's always, you know, been focused on the movable middle, the handful of independent voters who could go either way in the six swing states. And what he seems to be discounting is the progressives. And clearly the Michigan primary was a bit of a wake-up call, suddenly the large number of uncommitted votes in a swing state. And so we've seen him being more attentive, but I think he still calculates that progressives have no place to go. They're not going to vote for Trump, and abstaining is effectively a vote for Trump. So when push comes to shove in November, they're going to have to hold their nose and vote for Biden. And that seems to be what is pushing him at this stage.
Well, Ken Roth, I want to ask you to stay with us as we continue our discussion about U.S.'s foreign policy, visiting professor at the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs, served for nearly 30 years as executive director of Human Rights Watch. When we come back, Rwanda marks 30 years after the 1994 genocide. We'll speak with a survivor, and we'll look with Ken Roth at how the U.S., France, and other nations stood by, refusing to say the word genocide, afraid it would trigger force the use of the Genocide Convention. Stay with us. Back in 20 seconds. The Meaning of Death by the Rwandan gospel singer Kizito Mihigo, a survivor of the 1994 genocide. In 2020, he was found dead in a cell in Rwanda after being arrested days earlier. The song was released a decade ago, banned in Rwanda. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Rwanda is holding a week of commemorations marking the 30th anniversary of the 1994 genocide, when up to a million Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed by Hutu militias. During the genocide, at least 250,000 women were raped. As the world watched the horror unfold 30 years ago, the United States, France, and other nations stood by, refused to help stop the killing. The Rwandan president, Paul Kagame, said in a speech Sunday, the international community, quote, failed all of us. Former U.S. President Bill Clinton traveled to Rwanda this week to mark the 30th anniversary of the genocide, along with other foreign dignitaries. As President Clinton refused to label the 1994 mass killings in Rwanda's genocide, he has since said his failure to respond was one of his biggest regrets of his presidency. This is President Clinton speaking in 1998.
We did not immediately call these crimes by their rightful name. Genocide. We cannot change the past, but we can and must do everything in our power to help you build a future without fear.
In 2021, French President Emmanuel Macron acknowledged France's role in failing to stop the Rwandan genocide. The anniversary of the genocide comes at a time when Rwanda's longtime president, Paul Kagame, is coming under increasing criticism for his autocratic rule. To talk more about Rwanda 30 years after the genocide, we're joined by two guests. Still with us, Ken Roth served for nearly three decades as the executive director of Human Rights Watch, now visiting professor at the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. And joining us from Sydney, Australia, is Noel Zehabamwe, the founder and chairperson of the African Australian Advocacy Center. Both his parents were killed during the genocide. He's co-author of the book 1,000 Hills. Noel, thank you so much for being with us. Talk about what happened 30 years ago and ultimately why you had to leave Rwanda many years later. What happened to your parents?
First and foremost, let me start by thanking you for hosting me, Emery. 30 years ago, my country of birth descended into darkness and the pain of genocide. And I remember very well when I was with my parents and my younger sister, and I recall my daddy telling me that we see each other in heaven. That's the last word I had from my father, and since then, we never met again. That's what happened 30 years ago in April, when this darkness descended into a wonderful country, which is 1,000 Hills. And as I can say, I tragically not only lost my parents, I also lost immediate and extended family members.
And can you talk about the the role of the genocide in shaping how the international community looked at President Kagame's leadership? He was portrayed as a hero who ended the genocide.
It's very important to understand that everyone should see that the genocide was coming. And I agree with you saying that the international community has failed to save or to help Rwanda from descending into that tragedy. However, in 1994, I remember very well that there was a way that international community was going to stop the genocide, but they ended up not doing so. Like many, many victims, many Tutsis were being targeted, killed, and also, of course, as we said, many Hutus as well, and also Twa and the foreigners. There's no doubt that all those victims were being killed, and international community was standing by. So, however, when genocide ended in July, we all hoped that the country was going to be rebuilding itself. And also, many people, especially survivors, we thought that the Rwanda was going to be, again, a Rwanda we used to know when we were kids, like a Rwanda of a thousand hills. However, we started noticing that what we thought was going to be a country of peace, a country of harmony, we could see that there was the current Ruhinga regime, those other atrocities committed, actually targeting also the Hutus as well. So from April to July, Tutsis were mainly targeted, killed because they were Tutsis. And also when the government took over the current regime, we thought that storm was over, but we could see also there was other atrocities from RPF side. So what happened now? As I was a child, I remember I fled to Burundi, and then I came back in September. I went to orphanage center. That's where I spent my teenagerhood. When I finished high school, I went to university. When I started university, I started being approached, being coerced to join the current regime, which I refused because I didn't want to join in politics because one of the main problems Rwanda has always have is poor leadership. The leaders Rwanda has ever had, they don't look into big picture. They always look into narrow into those kind of I can say their own interest rather than looking into public to general interest. So then, when I was forced many times to join the Ruhinga Party, I was told that even though when you finish university, you may not get a job, you may even not get there. And then I continue, being chased away, and then I end up becoming again a refugee. Then I went to Kenya. I came to Australia. Coming to Australia, I started building my life from scratch. And then when I had my family, I became a community leader here. After becoming a community leader, I was approached by ambassador who was based in Singapore to work for them again. And then which I refused because I said I can't do that kind of a job. And then the price I was given, my two brothers, 5 years ago, on the 28th of September, were during the day removed from the bus. Since then, they have never been found again. Despite having credible evidences with the driver who was driving the bus and the passengers who have seen my brothers being removed from the bus, when I started claiming, asking for the government for help, the government refused to help me. Instead, they started tarnishing my image in the media that I'm lying, that I'm in opposition. So that's the kind of image many victims like me have. So being a victim of a genocide, once again, so being a victim of the regime that came to power, promising us to live in harmony and peace.
Noel, I wanted to talk about what's happening today with Paul Kagame's Rwanda, but I want to stay in 1994 for a moment, when the United States government carefully avoided using the word genocide to describe what was happening in Rwanda. This is a clip from PBS Frontline documentary Ghosts of Rwanda, beginning with a State Department briefing, April 28, 1994.
Comment on that, or a view as to whether or not what is happening could be genocide.
Well, as I think you know, the use of the term genocide has a very precise legal meaning, although it's not strictly a legal determination. There are other factors in there as well. When in looking at a situation to make a determination about that, before we begin to use that term, we have to know as much as possible about the facts of the situation.
Out of curiosity, given that so many people say that there is genocide underway or something that strongly resembles it, why wouldn't this convention be involved?
Well, I think, as you know, this becomes a legal definitional thing, unfortunately, in terms of as horrendous as all these things are, there becomes a definitional question.
That was Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State, speaking in 1994. Ken Roth, you were Human Rights Watch Executive Director at the time. We don't have much time, but explain what the U.S. didn't do.
Well, first of all, these word games with genocide were because there was a perceived obligation that if there is genocide, you have to suppress it. You have to act. And so they said, oh, it's maybe acts of genocide, which they thought meant something lesser. Now, this was a moment, it's hard to think back, but this was before Bush's invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. It was an era where Americans were very unused to the idea of American military casualties abroad. And Clinton was just not going to risk it further after the Black Hawk Down incident in Somalia. So he was determined not to send in troops. It's important to recognize that the Rwandan genocide was carried out by a rudimentary force, basically using hate radio, the infamous Radio Milkolin, to rally people with machetes to kill their neighbors. And Alison DeForge, my colleague at the time, who was really one of the world's experts on Rwanda, was convinced that two forces could have stopped the genocide. The UN peacekeepers, UNAMIR, and a French evacuation force that was sent in. But the French evacuation force evacuated the Westerners and left Rwandans to their fate. The UN Security Council, at U.S. urging, reduced the number of peacekeepers from 2,500 to 250 and never gave them a protective mandate. And so as a result, the genocide unfolded. And when Clinton, you know, apologizes today, it's because he did nothing to stop the genocide. Indeed, I remember we were meeting with Anthony Lake, the national security advisor of Clinton at the time, and he said, make more noise. In other words, we're not going to stop the genocide as a legal duty. We're not going to stop the genocide because we have a moral responsibility to do that. We're only going to stop it if there's no political cost, if the American people are demanding this of us. That was the complete abdication of moral responsibility of the Clinton administration.
And Ken, we only have about a minute left, but what parallels do you see with how the U.S. Acted or didn't act back then to the war we're facing right now with on the part of Israel and Gaza?
Well, one, interestingly, it would be easier for the U.S. to act today. In other words, in the case of Rwanda, it would have meant sending in troops. Nobody's going to send in troops to Gaza, but what the U.S. could do, as we were discussing, they could stop arming, they could stop funding the plausible genocide, the clear war crimes in Gaza. And so it's just a matter of saying the money and the arms will stop unless the killing and the starvation stops. That's all it would take, and Netanyahu would have to listen. Biden refuses to take that step.
And what do you think he could do at this point to turn this around?
It's as simple as that, Amy. In other words, if he were to say, you know, Netanyahu, I've had it with your game playing. I've had it with your pretending to comply with my concerns. This is it. You know, you've got to really stop bombing civilians. You've got to open up the gates and allow food in. And if that doesn't start today, the arms sales end tomorrow.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. And by the way, I want to say that at the time, 1994, Madeleine Albright was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, then became Secretary of State. I want to thank Ken Roth, who is former Executive Director of Human Rights Watch for close to 30 years, now visiting professor at the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. And I want to thank Noel Zahabamwe, who is founder and chair of the African Australian Advocacy Center, speaking to us from Australia, a survivor of the Rwandan genocide. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
In collaboration with the Nova Scotia Cooperative Council, and supported by Desjardins. Cooperatives and Mutuals Canada is honored to host the annual CMC Congress June 11 to 13th at the Halifax Convention Center in Nova Scotia. Under this year's theme of Navigating Change Together, join us for thought-provoking plenaries and participate in interactive workshops and breakout sessions. To learn more or register, please visit www.canada.coop now.
This is CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, independent and diverse campus community radio from Simon Fraser University.